Maybe I have to rethink this elevated train business. There might be some advantages to it after all. On a bitter lip in an effort not to laugh, and instead let out a small hiccup of sound. What was that? His breath warmed the shell of her ear and stirred the few loose hairs that curled against her temple. I didn't say anything. She was talking to his handkerchief, which was a brilliant white and beautifully embroidered, something she knew because she had its twin at home, the one he had given to her along with half his dinner in the taxi. The next morning she found it in her pocket, and now it sat on her dresser, laundered and ironed and folded to show the initials on one corner. GLM. She had been wondering for days what the L stood for. Lorenzo, Lucian, Leonardo, Lancelot, Lucifer, lunatic. Am I embarrassing you? She studied the way his feet were braced against the sway of the train's motion. Her own 2 feet, much smaller, between them. Feet entwined. She felt him smiling against her hair. I'll take that as a yes, he said. Jack could resist the swaying of the train because he was holding on to one of the overhead straps that were out of Anna's reach. She had nothing to hold on to. Nothing she could, in good conscience, hold on to. She must brush up against him at every curve. What is it you want, Mezzanotte? She said, putting some backbone into her voice. Did you want to kiss me on a crowded train? Is that an offer? Now his lips actually touched her ear, and goose flesh raced down her neck and her spine, to spark in places best not considered just at this moment. The train stopped, and the passengers inched toward the doors, flowing out over the platform and spreading to the stairwell where they came together again, a river pulsing through a canyon. With the car half empty, there was enough room to step away, but somehow, Anna found it almost impossible to move. It made her angry. How easily he took her calm from her. She said, You clearly have the wrong idea about me. I'm not a girl looking for an adventure. I'm not even a woman looking for an admirer. Too late, Jack said, on both counts. She drew in a sharp breath, took 3 steps back, and forced herself to count to 20. Then she looked up at him just as the train began to slow again, and she saw where they were. This is where we get off. He caught her wrist as she passed him and drew her back. Jack's hand was large and warm and rough, the hand of someone accustomed to hard work. She set her jaw and refused to raise her head. But she heard him laugh anyway. A short, low laugh. A satisfied sound. This is where we interrupt the journey, he corrected her. But not for long. This time the passengers were in no hurry, lingering on the platform in a way that made no sense to Anna until the train pulled away and the new suspension bridge came into view. It was monstrous in size, a long neck arching out over the river like a predatory bird watching for prey. Along the metal flanks, tenements cowered, saloons and dance halls and alleys all lost in shadow that would never go away. And still, it was beautiful. Anna couldn't remember the last time she had looked at the bridge closely, and she saw now what had once seemed unlikely. It was very near done. In just over a month, it would open to traffic. The bridge itself crawled with laborers, with drays and wagons and carts laden with building materials. As they watched, a wagon pulled out of the barn-like terminal that stood between the bridge itself and Park Place. They just started test runs, Jack told her. There would be a huge celebration with bands and fireworks and speeches, a summer party of sorts. She planned to walk from one side of the bridge to the other along the promenade. but she would likely wait until the early crowds had had their fill. She turned to Jack, who was studying the men at work. "Have you been on the bridge?" He glanced down at her and grinned.
"As often as I can find an excuse."
"What is it like?"
"Windy."
She raised a brow at him, impatient.
"I think you must be a hard taskmaster with your students," he said. And when her scowl deepened, he said, "It's like being a bird, looking out over the world."
"I was just thinking that," Anna told him. "It's like a bird of prey."
"If you want to see it for yourself, I'll take you up."
"To the top of the tower?"
Her voice broke, but she was too startled at the idea to pretend nonchalance. "The tower is solid stone. It's not like a church steeple. You can't climb up from the inside."
"That can't be true," Anna said. "The towers didn't grow like beanstalks, after all. There must be ladders fixed to the stone. Look, there's a flag flying at the top. Unless they've got fairies working for them, a human being climbed up there to mount it. I could do that."
She had surprised him out of his composure. "You're telling me that you want to climb the outside of the tower?"
"I said so. Don't you? Or have you already?"
Jack glanced around himself. Most everyone had drifted away, but he lowered his voice. "A stunt like that could get me suspended, if not fired."
Anna had to bite her lip hard to maintain a serious expression. "I see. You have been up to the top of one of the towers, but you won't take me up. Because I'm female?"
"Because you could break your neck."
She fluttered her fingers. "I was climbing trees at 4.
"Falling out of a tree is a different proposition than falling off a suspension bridge."
"So you won't take me up the tower?"
"No, but I will take you to the highest point on the promontory. Just as soon as weather and my schedule, both our schedules, permit."
Anna considered and decided to save the battle for another day. The intersection of Duane and Chambers streets was jammed with omnibuses, wagons, coaches, cabs, and every kind of dray, all competing for space with vendors hawking cookware, tools, knife sharpening, shoe shines, buttons and sewing needles, oysters on the half shell, pickles, nuts, sausage, cheese and curds, meat pies, and hard candy. Newsboys shouted for customers, bellowing the more exciting or salacious headlines from the 3 o'clock editions. Anna saw a younger man lounging against the wall of a coffee house, his eyes roaming the crowd and then stopping on Jack. He disappeared almost instantly, which was proof of what she had known in theory. Jack was known to more people in the city, good and bad, than she could ever count. The lodging house, constructed and run by the Children's Aid Society, was an imposing 4-story brick building that took up most of a city block. A clothier occupied the front of the ground floor, but the rest of it provided shelter and food for homeless boys. During the day, they hawked papers and matches, shined shoes, played battered violins on busy corners, lifted and hauled in factories and on the docks and wharves. There were scullery and stable and errand boys, rat catchers and wharf rats who stole what they could not earn or beg. Anna did not see them as hapless victims or as hardened criminals, but as children who simply refused to give up and die. An unprotected child who survived the streets of the city for even a month was a child who had learned to take advantage of any opportunity or to create opportunity where none existed. Though she was watchful and aware, Anna had had her pocket picked more than once. Early in her career, she had learned that poor children could not be left alone in an examination room or office. Even the youngest of them would take anything that might have value on the street, from a few inches of gauze to wooden tongue depressors, and once in a while, scalpels and retractors. Jack opened a door and they went up a staircase. The floorboards swept clean, the banisters polished, and not a single mark on the whitewashed walls. She wondered how the housekeeper managed it with so many boys under her roof. The reception area was almost empty in the middle of the afternoon, but for a high counter and off to one side, a smaller table where a single boy sat frowning at an exercise book. Behind the counter, a middle-aged man in shirt sleeves was writing in a ledger, while a woman sorted through the afternoon mail. Jack made a polite sound in his throat to get their attention, and succeeded.
"Jack, mezzanotte!" The woman held out both arms as if he were a favorite brother come home unexpectedly. She was red-cheeked and rounded, her hair piled up into a fuzzy top knot, but there was a sharp intelligence in her eyes and a stubborn set to her chin, and Anna had the sense that she was not to be trifled with. She was saying, "It's been too long. Where have you been keeping yourself?" Her gaze moved to Anna and her smile broadened. This time there was a dimple. Jack introduced her to Mr. and Mrs. Howell and presented Anna just by name and then, quite formally, added on the fact that she was a physician and surgeon. He did this as though a lady surgeon were nothing out of the ordinary, and still the cheerful look on both faces before them went momentarily blank with confusion. Then their enthusiasm and good manners reasserted themselves, and they lost no time ushering Jack and Anna into the manager's apartment just off the reception area. Mrs. Howell called to someone in the kitchen for tea, and then they sat down on well-used couches and faded chintz. For the next few minutes, they peppered Jack with questions about his well-being, his family, goings-on at police headquarters, the activities of the Italian Benevolent Society, and the case of one of their charges who had been arrested for theft. Once the tea had been set out by one of the Howells' daughters, Mrs. Howell's attention turned in another direction.
"And how do you know Dr. Savard, Jack?"
Jack leaned back and smiled at her. "I'll let Anna tell the story. It's why we're here." It was beginning to feel like a set piece. But Anna told it all. Mr. and Mrs. Howell listened closely, stopping her once in a while to ask questions.
"You examined all four of the children."
"Yes," Anna told Mrs. Howell. "They were all comparatively healthy. Tonino was very well grown for his age, quite strong. The baby was alert and not fearful." She described them in as much detail as she could give.
"Jenny," said Mr. Howell, looking at his wife.
She shook her head.
"The baby wouldn't come through our doors, and I haven't seen the older boy. It doesn't mean he hasn't been through here, but it's unlikely. I'll ask our Thomas when he gets home from his classes. He takes the desk every day for a few hours. And there's..."
She paused as a younger boy came into the parlor to lean against her chair and send longing glances to the plate of cookies that sat untouched on the table. Anna wondered how many children of their own they had raised in this very building.
"Timothy," said Mrs. Howell, "go see if Baldy is in, please. Tell him I need to talk to him right away."
She turned back to Anna.
"And in the meantime, I'd like to hear more about you, Dr. Savard."
Jack divided his attention between Hank's story of a boy who had been arrested for drawing a knife on another boy in the dormitory, and Jenny Howell's sure-handed solicitation of Anna's help in one more worthy cause. And he was listening at the same time for Baldy. It was no more than 5 minutes before he burst into the room as if the roundsmen were at his heels. The kid had enough energy to fuel all of New York's elevated train lines by himself.
"Did you want to see me, Ma Howell?"
Then he caught sight of Jack and drew up sharply, his long, gangly body suddenly utterly still.
"No trouble," Jack said. "I'm not here for you."
And he added something in Italian that made the boy both relax and smile.
"Sit yourself down," said Hank. "The detective sergeant and this lady are looking for a boy. and you might be able to help.
Baldy lowered himself onto a stool and nodded. While Jack talked, he listened with an expression that made it clear that while he would cooperate, he would not be so foolish as to believe anything this Detective Sergeant Mezzanotte had to say. A completely understandable proposition to take, after all. Jack had arrested him more than once. When Jack had finished, Baldy said,
"This kid, a Neapolitan with blue eyes."
"Blue eyes, black hair. Somebody like that would stick out.
You're sure he's Neapolitan?"
Jack nodded, and Baldy shook his head.
"Can't help you."
"You could ask around," Jack said. "See if Vince or Bogey or anybody in one of the gangs has seen him."
"I could," Baldy said.
His gaze had come to rest with obvious interest and curiosity on Anna.
"You took his sisters in, miss?"
"This is Dr. Savard," Jack corrected him.
"Dr. Savard, if you're in the market for homeless Italian kids, I could volunteer myself."
He thumped his chest with a fist.
"I am better than Italian. I'm 110% head-to-toes Siciliano."
"And you're not a child," Mrs. Howell said, "though you seem to forget from time to time. 18 is a man grown, or should be." The young man had a head of dark hair so thick that it stood straight up from his scalp, and beneath that, a clever mind. Jack had issued some kind of challenge that Anna didn't catch. But Baldy jumped right into a conversation that was half banter and half dispute and all in Italian. Anna leaned toward Mrs. Howell and lowered her voice. "Is there somewhere I could speak to Baldy alone for a half hour or so?" Anna closed the door to Mr. Howell's office behind herself and smiled at the boy's attempt to look both worldly and innocent. "Baldy," she began, and then interrupted herself with a question. "What is your real name, if I may ask? There must be something more dignified to call you." He inclined his head.
"I am Giustiniano Giambattista Garibaldi Nediani."
"I see." She paused.
"You don't like Baldy?"
"I don't dislike it, but it doesn't really suit you."
"I have a very long name," he said, "and I am very tall. If they had thought to give you a longer name, maybe you would have grown to a full size."
At that, Anna had to laugh out loud. "Maybe Anna isn't my full name," she said. "If you don't have a preference, I'll call you Nediani or Ned. Does that suit?" The boy gave an almost regal nod.
"What is it you want to know?"
Anna didn't have to prompt very hard to hear his very brief story. Orphaned at 8, abandoned by an uncle, 4 years on the streets, 3 of those as a newsie. Since then, he had been working at the lodging house as a jack-of-all-trades and pursuing other avenues of self-improvement, as he put it. He rattled off the facts with such ease that Anna didn't know what to think. It might be a well-rehearsed story, or a history that had to be handled like a live coal, cautiously, quickly, lest it do more damage. "You are still active as a newsie?"
"I outgrew that years ago, except for looking out for some of the younger boys. Mostly I'm busy here."
"Are you content to continue here, or do you have plans?" At this, he looked somewhat affronted.
"I have $322.55 in savings. You can ask Ma Howell. She keeps the books. I'm thinking, when I've got enough saved, I'll buy an interest in a shop."
"That's very enterprising of you," Anna said. "But it is slow going, saving for a better life."
"You got a job you want me to do, right? You want me to find this little kid for you?"
"Yes. I realize that we are asking you to look for a little boy you don't know, and that it might put you in a difficult position now and then to ask questions in certain quarters. On the other hand, you know the streets. Your experience and understanding of the way things work gives you a great advantage. He inclined his head.
True.
I'm asking you to act as a kind of unofficial detective, I suppose the title would be. And as such, you should be compensated. As if she had spoken Jack's name aloud, the boy said,
I don't want no business with no cops.
This arrangement is between you and me, Anna said. No one else. With the understanding that you will not put yourself in danger under any circumstances. He broke out in a wide and amused smile, and rightly so. It was naive to think he could avoid trouble, or even wanted to. She said, Now, about compensation. I've been thinking about it. Do I understand that staying here costs 10 cents a night?
For older boys. The little ones pay 6 cents. Another dime or two for meals, he said. Morning and evening, Ma Howell runs a good kitchen.
Very well, Anna said, endeavoring not to smile. Let's say $1.50 a week for your lodging and meals. $6 would cover 4 weeks. That will serve as a retainer. If you are successful tomorrow, or if we are successful, if anyone finds Tonino or reliable word of where he's gone, you will still keep the fee I am paying today. If you find him or reliable word of where he is, I will pay you another $10. If, in 4 weeks, there is still no word of him, we will reassess the situation and discuss whether to continue. Are these terms agreeable to you?
Yes, he said with great dignity. I accept.
She took papers from her bag and placed them on a corner of the desk. She had asked permission to use the pen and ink, and so she got those ready, too. Now, I believe that you've been attending classes since you first came here, and so you can read and write English. I'm going to write out our agreement here, and we'll both sign it. If that's acceptable.
I'm always ready. Right on, Dr. Savard.
When she returned to the parlor, both the manager and his wife had gone to take up their duties. Jack sat alone reading a paper, his legs stretched out and his ankles crossed. Something changed in his face when he saw her, but there was no suspicion there. She wondered if he was ever surprised by anything. She wondered if he played poker.
What?
Anna said, as he unfolded his long frame from the chair.
What?
She said again, as he stopped right in front of her, not touching but so close she could smell the starch in his shirt collar. He said,
Did you bribe that kid?
She raised her head sharply and took a step back. Jack moved 2 steps forward.
I paid him for his services,
Anna said, refusing to step away again and trying to convince herself this had to do with calm self-assertion and nothing else.
That's not bribery. Why must you always put things in terms of criminal behavior?
The corner of his mouth quirked. Because I'm a cop, he said, and Baldy is a criminal.
Anna felt her heart pick up a beat. He may have broken law, she began.
Laws, Jack said, multiple. Often with great skill and enthusiasm.
Well, Anna said, shifting in her irritation, of course he's no angel.
How much money did you give him?
$6 with the promise of a bonus if he's successful. And before you say anything else, Mezzanotte, you should know that if he just takes the $6 and never does anything to earn it, I will still consider the investment to have been worthwhile.
For a long moment, he looked down at her, a crease in the fold between his eyebrows, and one corner of his mouth pulled up as though she were a puzzle that resisted solving.
Come on, he said. We have a couple more stops to make.
Anna said, I'm almost afraid to ask.
For the next 2 weeks, Anna was on high alert and agitated with herself about it. Some days there was a note from Jack Mezzanotte with news about the search, But more often, when she left for the day, the porter would have a note asking her to meet somewhere. The Protestant orphan asylum, the Lady of the Rosary convent, the Boys' Protectory on Broom Street, the Sheltering Arms Home, the Society for the Relief of Destitute Children, the Asylum of St. Vincent de Paul. They would meet, talk to the head of the asylum or hospital, and go their separate ways. If it was dark when they finished, Jack insisted on seeing her home, and they talked of everything and nothing at all. Anna wondered if she had imagined his interest in her. But then he would come to call and sit down to talk to Rosa about what they had learned and where they would go next. And during those visits, she was well aware of his regard. He touched her often, in ways that a more strictly brought-up woman would not have allowed. She felt his hand on her shoulder, very briefly, or he touched her lower back when they made their way through one room to another, so lightly that she might have imagined it, if not for the satisfied look on Mrs. Lee's face. He was playful with the little girls and could even make Rosa laugh, while Leah giggled so hard that she would dissolve into hiccups. He told tall tales in English and Italian. He produced butterscotch drops out of a seemingly bottomless pocket. And all the time his gaze returned, again and again, to Anna. One early evening on an omnibus traveling down Broadway, he had picked up her hand and examined it as if it were some strange object found on a park bench. He undid the 3 mother-of-pearl buttons at her wrist, and then, too late, looked to her for permission. "May I?" She wanted to say that he should not, but somehow his manner was so disarming that she just nodded. "The only time I've ever seen you without gloves in public was on Randall's Island, when you treated that infant with..." He couldn't recall the name. "Ankyloglossia," Anna supplied. "He died that same week." After a moment, she said, "I only take off my gloves when I'm working or when I'm at home without chance of company." With a few quick tugs, he slipped it off and cradled her hand like an injured bird. And it was pitiful, rough and red and swollen, the nails cut to the quick for the sake of antisepsis. There was no denying that her hands were terrible. "I wash, I scrub my hands and forearms dozens of times every day."
"What exactly do you use?"
"We used to scrub nails, hands, and lower arms with potash soap, and then rinse with a 5% carbolic acid solution."
"Used to?"
"It worked fairly well. You can tell by dipping your hands in nutritive gelatin just after finishing the process. If no microbes grow in that culture in 3 days, that's proof that the regimen is killing all infectious agents. Unfortunately, it was also horrendously hard on our hands. So now we start with scrubbing as before, but rinse first with 80% alcohol for a minute and then a 3% carbolic acid solution. It works as a sterile procedure and isn't quite so hard on the hands. Still, Mrs. Lee's hands are not nearly as bad, and she's been scrubbing floors for all of her life." She was rambling, but it was hard to watch him studying her hand while her fingers twitched ever so slightly. "The whole thing is made more complicated by the fact that I can't operate if there's even the slightest break in my skin. Then I put myself at risk. Someday they will come up with a better way to protect the patient and the surgeon both from infection." And then, more hesitantly, "Are you put off by my hands?" She had startled him. He raised his head to frown at her.
"That would be very narrow-minded of me."
Anna tried to draw her hand away, but he held on to it, his grip gentle but unyielding. For a moment, she had the sense he might kiss her palm, and the idea of his tongue against her skin made her squirm. "Don't," she said quietly, and with fingers that were almost numb, put the glove back on.
"What you need," Jack said after a long moment, is some kind of glove made out of thin material. Not cloth, that wouldn't work. Something like...
His expression went momentarily blank, and then cleared.
Something like condoms, for the fingers and hands.
The image that came to mind was outrageously funny, and intriguing somehow. He said,
Condoms are made out of lamb intestines, I think. If they could be sterilized and sewn into a glove, wouldn't that work?
Anna couldn't help smiling. This must be the oddest conversation of all time.
But wouldn't it work?
She thought for a moment. That particular material is permeable, so the surgeon would still have to scrub diligently. I don't think soap alone would be enough.
But say for a minute that it's possible to sew a sterilized glove out of lamb's intestine or something similar. You could test it with your gelatin, what did you call it?
Nutritive.
To see if microbes grow. And if they did, you could experiment with different kinds of materials and sterilization and how to treat your hands first, until you got the right combination.
That would likely take years, Anna said, and someone willing to do the labor, the curing and sewing and sterilizing.
But it might just work, Jack said. It's worth thinking about at the very least.
That evening, when he walked her to her door, he paused in the shadow of the garden wall to kiss her.
Savard, he said against her mouth. I spend a lot of time thinking about you. Night and day I think about you. And it's not your hands that first come to mind.
He kissed her again, thoroughly, roughly, and then waited until she had opened the door.
I'm thinking about those gloves, he called up to her, even if you aren't.
Chapter 11. At the very beginning of her medical training, Sophie had realized that the most difficult challenge she would face was not chemistry or pathology, but what Aunt Quinlan called her tender-hearted nature. Medicine demanded calm, rational, reasoned thinking and quick decisions. The ability, the willingness, to cause discomfort and even pain in pursuit of a cure. Sophie learned to think of her heart as something she had to put away, lock away, while she worked. Children died of diseases that were preventable. Women died in childbirth despite the very best medical care. They came to her with cancers of the breast and womb and mind, with hands crushed in factory accidents, with burns and broken bones, with their fears and their stories. She listened, and where she could, she helped. She sometimes, too often, failed. As now she feared she was failing Rosa. Certainly, she had had no real comfort to offer when they took the girls to Blackwell's Island to see their father buried. Leah took comfort in being held and rocked and read to. Rosa, calm, efficient, ferocious Rosa, had retreated into her sorrow and anger and would accept nothing from anyone. The only time she seemed to relax at all was when she was in the garden with Mr. Lee. And it was only with Leah that she allowed herself to bend when her little sister remembered suddenly that they had found and lost their father on the same day. Rosa wanted nothing for herself and was almost impossible to engage in any conversation unless it had to do with her brothers. For almost 3 weeks now, Anna and Jack had been visiting child welfare institutions whenever they both had a few hours to spare. Twice or three times a week, he would come for supper and then afterward sit at the kitchen table with Rosa and go over where they had been and what they had discovered. It was an impressive list and a disappointing one. They had interviewed staff and children at the Society for the Protection of Endangered Children, the Children's Aid Society Office and Lodging House, the Howard Mission, the Shepherd's Fold, the Leek and Watts Orphan Asylum, the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Children, the orphan asylums run by the Episcopal, Protestant, Baptist, and Methodist churches. Within the next few days, they would start visiting Roman Catholic orphan asylums together. They made other inquiries, too, that they did not tell Rosa about, and might not simply because they hoped it would never occur to her that her brothers could be someplace far worse than an orphan asylum. Just now, Jack and Anna were in the kitchen talking to Aunt Quinlan and Rosa. From the open door came the sound of voices rising and falling in a regular rhythm, and then Rosa's voice rose and wobbled and broke. She so seldom cried that Sophie wondered what news Jack had brought. Sophie got up from her spot in the garden and held out her hand to Leah.
"Shall we go for a walk?"
The little girl had begun to show some of the roundness that was appropriate to her age. Her hair had taken on a glossiness, and her coloring was high. Where her sister was weighed down by worry, Leah was relentlessly calm, cheerful, and affectionate. Mrs. Lee reported that the only time she had seen the girl cry was when Margaret and Aunt Quinlan had been arguing about the relative importance and value of corsets, a difference of opinion that was aired daily. Leah's unhappiness, Mrs. Lee believed, came from the inability to climb into both laps at once to offer comfort. Now Leah skipped along at Sophie's side, singing to herself, a melody Sophie didn't recognize. She held one of the old dolls from the attic firmly by a leg, and seemed unaware of or unconcerned by the doll's head dragging along behind her. When they sat down on a bench in the early evening light, Leah began to undress the doll, holding a conversation with her that sounded very much like Margaret talking to Leah herself. Suddenly, she stopped and looked up at Sophie.
"What's a corset?"
Sophie had been waiting for this question, but she had assumed it would come from Rosa, who was at the center of the disagreement between Margaret and Aunt Quinlan.
"A corset is a kind of chemise."
Leah's expression was puzzled. Sophie doubted that even Aunt Quinlan knew the Italian word for chemise, and so she touched the doll's old-fashioned undergarment, knee-length and low in the bosom, with sleeves that came to the elbow.
"This is a chemise. You wear one shorter than this."
Leah still looked puzzled, and then her face cleared as she made a decision. She grabbed her pinafore, skirts, and petticoats in both hands and hefted them to peer down at her own belly and the cotton chemise that covered it. Sophie gently disengaged her little hands and smoothed down the skirts.
"A corset is a kind of chemise," Sophie repeated, "but not soft. It's made out of very stiff material. Some ladies wear corsets because if they are tight enough, it pinches in to make their middles look very small. They do this to be fashionable."
She made a motion in the air, the outline of a woman with a tightly cinched waist. Leah squeezed the rag doll's lumpy middle, frowning in concentration. She said,
"Aunt Margaret wants Rosa to wear a corset."
It didn't surprise Sophie to hear this from Leah. While Italian was her first language, the little girl had an acute ear and could parrot things exactly, even if she didn't entirely understand them. Sophie said,
"Aunt Margaret thinks that all young girls should start wearing corsets as soon as possible, because she did as a girl. But Aunt Quinlan doesn't like corsets."
"No, she doesn't. She didn't allow Anna or me to wear them, not ever, because she believes corsets..."
She paused and rethought her approach.
"Girls who wear tight corsets can't run and play or climb trees or do anything much except sit. Aunt Quinlan says that being free to move is more important than this."
She made the same figure in the air. She could have added her own medical opinion and Anna's, but Leah had heard enough. The little girl propelled herself from the bench and onto the lawn, where she stopped to spin in place with her arms extended, the half-dressed doll still firmly in hand. Then she loped off, yelling behind herself,
I am the wind.
Yes, you are, Sophie said with a laugh. And so you shall always be.
By the time Sophie and Leah got back, Jack Mezzanotte had gone home and Anna off to bed in anticipation of an early and difficult surgery. But Margaret was waiting, and she immediately grabbed up Leah. Past her bath time, she said to Sophie. At the stairs, she paused. Mail came for you while you were out. Sophie waved goodbye to Leah, who still held the half-dressed doll in one grubby hand. On the hall table were two letters and a small packet that took her breath away. She would have recognized it by shape in a dark room, so often had she held it in her hand. The last time, more than a year ago. Cap had written the address himself. Very deliberately, she put it aside and picked up the first letter, waiting for the frantic beat of her heart to settle. The handwriting was unfamiliar, an awkward scrawl that was nothing like Cap's measured, angular hand.
Dear Dr. Savard, I write with the news that I have no news. I have spoke to the Arabs who run gangs from the Battery to the park, and nobody remembers a Guinea boy with dark hair and blue eyes, about 7 years old or any other age. I also had a look around certain establishments you wouldn't be familiar with. Places Detective Sergeant Mezzanotte can tell you about if you ask. No trace of the boy at the hurdy-gurdy, Billy McGlory's and the like. Nor did I hear of him in worse places still. I've got business up Haymarket Way this coming week, and we'll see what there is to see. With any luck, nothing at all. Better a train headed west than the Black and Tan or one of the Chinese opium joints. That's my opinion. I'll write again as soon as I have something to report, good or bad. Your humble servant, G. Giambattista Garibaldi Nediani. Ned.
Despite the serious subject matter, Sophie had to smile. Anna's description of Ned had been almost as colorful as the letter. She put it aside for Anna's attention. The second letter had been written by someone with a clean, nimble hand that was also unfamiliar to her.
Dear Dr. Sophie, it is just a few weeks since we had the pleasure of welcoming you to our home on a beautiful spring afternoon, and now I find myself writing not as I had hoped to invite you for another visit, but to share the news of my husband's sudden death. We laid Sam to rest on what would have been our 52nd anniversary, just 4 days ago. We are steadfast in our faith in our Lord Jesus Christ, and take comfort in his tender mercies. He has called Sam to his side, and one day he will call me to join him. Until then, I have family to look after and work to do. Aside from this sad news, I am also writing to say that our eldest grandson, also called Samuel Reason, has taken over the printing shop. You didn't meet Sam when you were here because he was on his way home from Savannah, where he was visiting his wife's family. Now he asks for permission to call on you to discuss business matters. If you could send word to him at the shop on Hunterfly Road about when he might call, I would be thankful for your help during this difficult time. I hope you know that you are welcome here at any time for any reason, and that you will not wait long to visit. With sincere good regards and many thanks for the care and kindness you showed my beloved husband, I remain your true friend, Mrs. Delilah Reason.
Sophie sat quietly for a long time, thinking about Sam Reason. Mrs. Reason had her children and grandchildren, sisters and brothers and friends to support her and give her purpose. More than that, she had 52 years of memories to sustain her, an abundance Sophie found hard to imagine as she weighed Cap's unopened package in her hand. Very carefully, she clipped the string and folded away the thick brown paper wrapping. Inside, she found the familiar, much-loved pen case that had passed back and forth between Cap and herself for 10 years, always with a letter enclosed, and sometimes with more. She had thought never to see it again, and so for a moment she only studied it, tracing the carving of a single tree beside a lake of inlaid pearl. Finally, she opened it, to take out a letter of many pages, rolled into a tube, and tied with a bit of string. She was terrified and exultant all at once. Sophie, my love. Nothing has ever felt more right than the act of breaking the long and painful silence that I created between us. I could make no accusations if you were to tear up this letter without reading another word, but I hope you will not. I have things I must say to you. I have hurt you and disappointed you, and told myself that I acted for your own good. You know that my fears for your health are founded in fact, but I must now confess that while I could not admit it to myself at the time, my decision to cut you off was about more than your health. I was angry, because I wanted you for my wife and you rejected me, and so, to my shame, I rejected you and convinced myself it was the right thing to do. Then Aunt Q came to call, and when she went away, she took my delusions and pretenses with her. I have been cruel and unfeeling, and I can only ask your forgiveness. I hope you will be more generous than I have been, though I don't deserve it. I have missed you. Every day, every hour, every minute I have missed you. You must know that I love you still and always, as I have loved you since that June we were 16, standing in the shade of the rose arbor, my senses filled up with the scent of the flowers and the low hum of the bees, and then with you and nothing else. Your taste, the texture of your skin at the corner of your mouth, the very sound of your breath catching in your throat. I loved you then as I will love you on the day I die. And I will die, Sophie, and my death will come too soon. And so I come to the letter from Dr. Tsangala, which your good aunt brought me. I have read it many times, and in the end, I cannot believe that Dr. Tsangala's methods will provide a cure. But I do think that his treatment might give me more time than I would otherwise have. You want me to go to Switzerland and put myself in Dr. Tsangala's care at the Rosenau Clinic. I will agree with some conditions. However much time I may have, you and I will spend it together. You must come with me to Switzerland and stay with me until the end, whether it comes in a week or 6 months, or even, as unlikely as it seems, a year. I want you to be my wife, and when my time is done, my widow. Before we depart for Europe, we must be married in a legal ceremony with your family and witnesses of my choosing in attendance. Our marriage must be announced in the papers both before and after the fact. Whatever the uproar and accusations and scandal, nothing will be done in secret. We will not share a bed or any kind of physical intimacy beyond the care a physician provides for a patient. You and I will both take every measure to ensure that I do not infect you or anyone else. There must be no ambiguity about our status as man and wife, and thus the platonic nature of our marriage must not be public knowledge. You will promise to present yourself to the world as my wife in all ways, even after I am gone. This has to do with the law, and only secondarily with my pride. When you are my widow, you will accept all rights and properties that come to you in accordance with the terms of my last will and testament, in which you will be named as my sole heir, with the exception of provisions for Mrs. Harrison and the staff in their old age. You can be sure of two things. The testament will be rock solid and unbreakable, and one or more of my aunts or cousins will attempt to break it anyway in order to deny you your inheritance. To protect your interests,
I will make arrangements for the very best legal counsel to represent you before the courts in this and any other matter. Uncle Conrad will be the executor of my will, and he will coordinate all aspects of my estate, working with the other attorney I have engaged, but your word will be final. What you do with the estate once it is released to you will be entirely and exclusively up to you. If you choose to build a hospital, to donate it all to a school, or simply to live in comfort for the rest of your life, no one will be able to interfere with you. I know you, Sophie, and you are thinking just now that you don't care about money or property. But I do care. This is what I want, and in this point, I will not be denied. Before I fell ill, you told me again and again that you loved me but could not marry me. You imagined that in time I would come to resent you. Somehow you convinced yourself that I would miss taking tea with old aunts and regret the lost opportunity to guide debutantes around the dance floor, that gossip and fashion and interminable talk of bloodlines would become more important to me over time. You were wrong. You are wrong. But none of that matters once we are married and away from this city. Distance and death will put an end to whatever disapproval my Aunt Eugenie or Mrs. Astor and her ilk can bestow. And you will be mine, and I will be yours. And that is all that matters to me. In the days and hours of my life, you are all and everything. It is a fine thing for me to ask for mercy where I showed none, but please do not make me wait long for your answer. I am ever yours, Cap. Chapter 12. Sophie started out of sleep at the first crow of Leah's beloved rooster and realized that she was still wearing yesterday's clothes. She had drifted off rereading Cap's letter, which she still held pressed to herself. Cap, who loved her and wanted her for his widow. She needed to talk to Anna before she sat down to write a single word. With a sudden burst of energy, she went about getting ready for the day, washing without looking at her face in the mirror for fear of what she might see there. No more than 15 minutes later, she slipped into Anna's room. An early morning visit. Anna stretched luxuriously, arms extended over her head. I thought it might be Leah. She has been coming in quite often recently to tell me her stories. Then she looked at Sophie more closely and sat up, fully awake. Sophie found that she couldn't say anything at all, and so she held up the letter. Anna smiled broadly, both dimples popping into view. Finally, read it. She frowned. Sophie, it's too personal. Please. I wouldn't know where to start to put it in my own words, and I need your advice. That made Anna laugh out loud. When is the last time you took my advice? But she accepted the letter and began to read. Anna was a slow reader, and always had been. It was the judge in her, Aunt Quinlan always said. She had to weigh every word before she could go on to the next. When she put the letter down, finally, she looked up at Sophie with tears in her eyes. What are you going to do? Sophie came forward and sat beside her cousin, folded her hands in her lap, and felt the relief and joy blossom inside her. She would say the words now and make it true. I'm going to marry him. Of course. And then, because she needed to be honest with herself, I'm going to marry him and then be with him when he dies. Anna put her arms around Sophie's shoulders and pulled her close. Are you happy? It seems wrong, but I am. Anna stroked Sophie's hair. You're marrying Cap because you love him and you want to be with him for what time he has left. There was something in Anna's tone that struck Sophie as odd. She studied her cousin's face and was not comforted by what she saw there.
Tell me.
Anna didn't pretend to be confused. Instead, she picked up the letter and ran her eye over it until she found a specific phrase. She cleared her throat and read aloud, "You want me to go to Switzerland and put myself in Dr. Zengerle's care at the Rosenau Clinic." A small tingle began at the bottom of Sophie's spine. Something was off, but her thoughts were racing so frantically she couldn't catch the one she needed. Very gently, Anna said, "How did Cap know the name of the village? It wasn't mentioned in any of the materials as far as I remember. Was it?" Sophie knew Dr. Sengerla's letters almost word by word, and she didn't recall any mention of a village called Rosenau. For 10 seconds, she held herself completely still, and then she let out a barking laugh.
"This is too much, even for Cap."
But even as she said it, Sophie knew that it was not. Cap was more than capable of planning complex, long-reaching schemes. He took huge satisfaction in them. She had refused him, but he had never given up. Not really.
"This is an insane idea. Are we really thinking that Cap cut himself off from me as a..."
She reached for a word that would not come.
"Strategy,"
Anna supplied.
"Yes, I think maybe he did."
"So he was in contact with Zengerle more than a year ago. But why a year? Why set this up and wait a year?"
Anna spread her hands over her lap and considered.
"He was aiming for your tipping point. The day you would be lonely enough for him to say yes to this."
She touched the letter.
"But Sengerla's letter, how could he have timed that?"
"By holding off and then delivering it himself. It wasn't dated, if I remember correctly." Sophie felt herself flushing with anger and amusement, frustration and resignation.
"What a stupid chance he took. What cheek, the underhanded swindler. Could he have really been so desperate?"
"Hold on," Anna said. "We're just speculating. This might not be what it seems." Sophie let out a sputtering laugh.
"Oh, please. Once you pointed it out, it's obvious that it's one of his schemes."
She put her face in her hands.
"He kept us apart for a whole year to force this marriage."
Her shoulders shook, but she wasn't sure if she was on the brink of laughter or tears.
"He knows you too well," Anna said. "A year ago, would you have accepted him under the same circumstances?"
Sophie tried to imagine how she would have reacted to this particular proposal. She had been so sure of herself when she refused him.
"I don't know. I doubt it,"
Anna said.
"I can't get over the fact that he drew Dr. Sengerla into this scheme."
"Really?" Sophie said, taking out her handkerchief to wipe her eyes.
"Now that I think about it, I'm wondering why it took so long."
She rolled over and pressed her face into Anna's pillow so that she could scream without rousing the house. Later, buttoning her shoes, Anna watched Sophie put the last pins in her hair. There was another subject she wanted to raise. She just couldn't imagine holding her own news back for a whole day. When she looked up again, her cousin was studying her. Sophie said,
"What is it? Jack?"
Anna drew in a deep breath and nodded.
"Has it come that far?"
She lifted a shoulder and held out a hand, palm up.
"Let's just say that I need to speak frankly to him before things go any further."
Sophie's usual calm manner had returned, and Anna was glad of it. She said,
"What are you going to tell him, exactly?"
"Everything," Anna said. "I have to tell him everything."
"Yes," Sophie said. "Do that, and leave no room for misunderstanding."
They went to work as if it were any other day. Anna off to the New Amsterdam, where she had 3 surgeries scheduled, students to meet with and patients to see. Sophie took the L and then an omnibus all the way north to the infant hospital and made the rounds with medical students, examined incoming patients, signed 3 death certificates, and taught a nursing student how to care for a surgical incision that was still draining. She put everything into her work, and still, when she allowed to look at the watch pinned to her bodice, the hands seemed not to have moved at all. At 3, when she had finished with a difficult case, she went to see Dr. Granqvist, who served as the hospital's administrator. Pius Granqvist was a 50-year-old native of Sweden, a man who had been working with sick children for all of his career. He was nondescript, fairly short and thin, with a frizzle of dark hair on the very top of his head and bushy eyebrows that he twisted at the ends into kinked horns. On first meeting him, she had wondered if children found him frightening, but then she saw how his smile transformed him. His whole face changed shape, his mouth too wide, his nose too small, and his eyes disappearing into a mass of wrinkles. He looked like a sprite or an elf, but he was as gentle as any mother when he examined a frightened child. With his staff, he was neither gentle nor amusing. He ran the hospital like a dictator. Where he had no authority, he took it anyway, and narrowed his eyes at anyone who would gainsay him. And he did not like Sophie's news at all.
"You can't leave," he said shortly. "You're the best we have."
"Thank you for the compliment," Sophie said, "but I am leaving to get married."
Saying the words out loud made her swallow hard. The director's mouth puckered, as if he had taken a mouthful of vinegar.
"Anybody can get married, Dr. Savard. Few people can do what you do. Your fellow can find someone else to marry, but I can't find another doctor like you."
Because Sophie had anticipated this reaction, she had taken the time to write out her resignation in very formal language. Now she put the document on his desk. He jerked away and wrinkled his nose, as though she had put a decomposing rat in front of him.
"This is my official resignation letter. 3 weeks from today will be my last day on the staff."
When she left his office, her hands were shaking, but otherwise she felt great relief. She had wondered if she would feel regret or even resentment, and found instead a heady joy, a child let out of school for the summer. She so rarely took time away from work, she had forgotten what it felt like to put down the multitude of burdens, small and large, just to breathe. In another day, or even an hour, she would begin to feel guilty. That was inevitable. But she would put it off as long as possible. In her office, she sat down to finish her chart notes, and then she took a piece of her own stationery and wrote out the note she had been composing in her head for a day.
"Dearest, today I handed in my resignation at the infant hospital, and tomorrow I will do the same at the New Amsterdam and the colored infirmary. On Saturday I will come to call mid-morning so that we can talk about Switzerland. With all my love, your Sophie."
It was her intention to have everything organized and in order before she went to see him. She wouldn't give him any opportunity to change his mind or the terms he had offered. Given all he had arranged to force her hand, it would be foolish to underestimate his propensity for forging and then taking advantage of the tiniest of loopholes. She stopped at the New Amsterdam to check on a patient before heading home for the day, and had just gone into her office when there was a soft knock at the door. The student nurse who came in bobbed her head in apology.
"A Mrs. Campbell is here to see you. She says she doesn't have an appointment."
It took a moment to place the name, and then it came to her. Mrs. Campbell, 4 little boys and a postal inspector husband, one of Comstock's henchmen. Dr. Heath's patient, but here and asking to see her.
"Thank you, Mrs. Henshaw," Just a postpartum exam. Please send her in.
Just recently, there had been a rash of letters sent to the house by strangers pleading for medical intervention and contraceptives. And now she wondered if this visit could be coincidence, or if it was just another one of Comstock's tricks. Those thoughts left her as soon as Mrs. Campbell came in. She was a physician first, and she recognized that this woman was in trouble. She was very pale, the flesh around her eyes so dark that in the first moment, Sophie thought of healing bruises, and then saw just what would be expected when a woman had 3 small children and a new infant, without household help. Sleeplessness was to be her lot for some time to come. Sleeplessness and irritability, and perhaps full-blown depression. Mrs. Campbell was a woman taxed to the point of breakdown.
Dr. Savard, may I speak to you?
A month before, Mrs. Campbell had been rounded, cheek and hip and thigh, and strong. Now her jaw and cheekbones were more prominent, and there was a brittleness in the way she held herself. Sophie gestured to a chair.
Please.
The fewer questions she asked at this stage, the sooner a patient would come to the point. Mrs. Campbell started slowly, relating facts about the new baby and the older 3, her hands clasped in her lap so hard that her knuckles went white.
And how are you? How is your health?
Mrs. Campbell drew in a breath and held it for 3 heartbeats.
I don't know, she said. I don't know how I am.
Have you seen Dr. Heath since the birth?
She shook her head quite sharply.
Then what can I do for you today?
The pale face came up suddenly, her gaze fixed on Sophie.
I want you to examine me.
Rather than ask questions, Sophie went to wash her hands, while Mrs. Campbell disrobed behind the privacy screen. Throughout the examination, she was quiet and cooperative, staring at the ceiling overhead blankly, hands still wound together.
You are healing well, Sophie said, but you are losing weight and too quickly. You need 4 or 5 small meals throughout the day, nothing too heavy or spicy. A poached egg and a piece of bread would do, or oatmeal with cream. Meat or fish once a day, but in small amounts. Leeks, collard, spinach, any kind of bean will provide you with the iron you need as a nursing mother.
The thin mouth contorted and an arm came up to cover her eyes.
I'm pregnant, aren't I?
Sophie had turned away to pick up an instrument, but she looked over her shoulder in surprise.
Pardon?
Mrs. Campbell sat up, rough patches of color rising in her cheeks.
I know I am. I can always tell.
What makes you think that? Have you missed your menses?
I haven't had a period for 4 years, Mrs. Campbell said. Doesn't seem to matter. I fall pregnant anyway.
I saw no indication of pregnancy, Sophie said.
But I could be, Mrs. Campbell said. He's been at me morning and night. I could be. And if not now, then next week.
Sophie spread out a hand.
It's not likely, Mrs. Campbell, but it's possible. In any case, there isn't any way for me to diagnose a pregnancy at such an early stage.
I know what I know.
There were tears in her eyes. Women often did know very early that they had conceived, but in this case, it was hard to say. Mrs. Campbell might still be feeling the after effects of pregnancy and birth, or in her anxiety and fear, because she was terribly afraid without doubt, she could convince herself of something that simply wasn't true. But she could be pregnant. Children born 10 months apart were not all that unusual.
Would you like me to write a letter ordering no intimacies for health reasons until further notice?
He wouldn't credit it,
Mrs. Campbell said bitterly. And that was certainly true. Mr. Campbell would ignore what she had to say. The situation was simple and familiar and heart-rending. because Sophie had no solutions to offer. She could not even ask if Mrs. Campbell had received the pamphlet she had sent, because she still could not be absolutely sure of the woman's true purpose. Mrs. Campbell spoke under her breath, as if giving Sophie permission to ignore her.
I cannot have another baby so soon. It will kill me.
Sophie could simply send the woman on her way with a few carefully chosen platitudes. It would be the safest and soundest thing to do. But it would also be cowardly, and worse, a violation of the oath she had taken. She must try, at least, to pass on information the woman could use to help herself. For a moment, she imagined Anthony Comstock standing out in the hall, a smirk on his face. And then she looked at her patient, and all other concerns had to be set aside.
You realize the importance of attention to hygiene while you are still healing.
Mrs. Campbell's expression shifted, something of hope there now.
I have heard something about that, but I don't know where to start.
Let me explain to you about the most effective ways to maintain personal hygiene. If you have time?
I do, Mrs. Campbell said. For this, I do have time.
An hour later, as she was getting ready to leave, Janine Campbell paused, as if she had something she needed to say, but would leave unsaid without encouragement.
Mrs. Campbell, I can't promise to have an answer to every question, but I will do what I can for you.
If scrupulous attention to personal hygiene is not enough, if I am already pregnant.
The silence drew out for a long moment.
Mrs. Campbell, Sophie said quietly, I have given you all the information I have to share.
She closed her eyes for a moment, then opened them, looking resigned.
But I can come back to see you.
Normally, I would be happy to have you as a patient, Sophie said. But I am just about to leave on a longer journey. I may be gone a year or possibly more. Or far less, she added to herself.
It often fell to Sophie to give a patient very bad news. An imminent stillbirth, malignant tumors that could not be excised, a child who would not survive the night. She had seen all manner of grief and sorrow and anger, raging and tears, and those who fell away into unconsciousness rather than face tragedy. She was seeing many of those things on Mrs. Campbell's face, along with a cold resignation, and the force of it struck her.
I have a number of colleagues who would give you excellent care, Sophie said. Shall I give you some names? Female physicians, women I went to school with.
No,
Janine Campbell said, her voice low and soft and hoarse.
No, I'll figure something out. But thank you.
Anna got to the hospital at dawn, just as a cab pulled up. The door flew open, and Sister Mary Augustine jumped down before the cabbie could even get off the box. She was so intent on helping Sister Frances Xavier step down safely that she didn't notice Anna standing a few feet away. What Anna saw was that the older nun and the cabbie wore almost identical expressions. Crank it, Aunt Quinlan would have called it. A bit of Scots left over from her first marriage. While Sister Xavier fussed at Mary Augustine, the cab driver dumped their satchels on the ground and turned to stalk away. Anna called after him.
Take those inside, please, she said, and leave them with the porter.
He gave her a long and speculative look, which Anna took to mean that he had been paid but not tipped. Nuns might not know about what a working man has coming, his look seemed to say, but you should. Anna produced a $0.25 from her pocket and held it up. The cabbie retrieved the bags with a surly grunt.
Dr. Savard.
Sister Xavier's voice was hoarse and brimming with impatience. Anna didn't expect pleasantries from people in pain, But then again, she was glad that Mary Augustine had been sent along as Xavier's private nurse. Now she smiled at both of them.
"Good morning," she said. "Come, I'll show you to your room and you can make yourself comfortable."
"Comfortable?" sputtered Sister Xavier. "I'm too old for fairy tales, and so are you."
Mary Augustine did what she could to put her very agitated patient at ease. But by the time Sister Xavier was settled in the bed, all color had drained from her face, and her complexion was the texture of candle wax. It was very wrong, Mary Augustine told herself, to be so happy under these circumstances, to take pleasure in an opportunity that existed only because of Sister Xavier's pain was something she would have to confess. But absolution required repentance, and that was something she could not manage. She had been hoping for this ever since the day in Hoboken when she learned that women could be doctors and surgeons. She had tried to put that idea, that outrageous, impossible, unattainable idea, out of her head, without success. There was a soft knock at the door, and things began to happen very quickly. Later, she would have trouble sorting it all out. Nurses and medical students came and went, sometimes, it seemed, with the sole purpose of irritating Sister Xavier, which wasn't very hard to do anyway. Then Dr. Savard came in, pushing a cart full of equipment, trailing two assistants behind her. Under other circumstances, the look on Sister Xavier's face might have struck her as funny, but it was only later that she could smile about it to herself. Fortunately, Dr. Savard didn't seem put out by the tone of questions that came her way in such rapid fire. She introduced her assistants as medical students and explained the purpose of the different objects on the rolling cart. The stethoscope made it possible to listen to the heart beating and blood moving. Sister Xavier shot Mary a sharp and questioning look, and she nodded. "And that?" She pointed to a contraption that was quite odd, with multiple arms and pads and bulbs of India rubber. "There's a needle in there somewhere, I know it."
"No needles," Dr. Savard said calmly. "This is a sphygmomanometer."
"A what?"
"A sphygmomanometer."
She pulled up the single stool in the room and sat on it. That simple act seemed to make Sister Xavier relax.
"Your heart beats to push blood through your arteries. The blood brings oxygen and nutrition to the cells," she said in a tone of voice that had nothing schoolmarmish about it. "The force of the pulsing of the blood puts pressure on the walls of those arteries. This machine," she touched it almost gently, "measures that. Your blood pressure."
"And why do you need to know about my blood pressure?"
Sister Xavier was trying to sound irritated and failing. Dr. Savard had tapped her curiosity and disarmed her completely. "It's useful information for a surgeon," Dr. Savard said. "It will influence the kind and duration of anesthesia we use."
"Anesthesia?"
Sister Xavier grabbed onto the word.
"Anesthesia?"
At that moment, Dr. Savard seemed to realize the source of Sister Xavier's agitation.
"Did you think you would be awake for the procedure?"
Dr. Savard said.
"I should have made clear to you, and I apologize."
She turned to her assistants.
"Bring in one of the gas ether regulators, please," she said, "so I can explain the way it works to Sister Xavier."
Chapter 13. "So," Moroni said, sliding into his desk chair and leaning back with his hands behind his head, "I see you got a private letter this morning." Jack let out a whistling breath. "Here," he said, and tossed it onto Oscar's desk. "Read it yourself." It was the path of least resistance, Jack told himself. Maybe he should have done this weeks ago and saved himself the hen pecking.
"Mezzanotte,"
Oscar read aloud, and paused to raise an eyebrow in Jack's direction before he went on.
Sister Mary Augustine will be here in the hospital for the next 3 or 4 days looking after a patient from the convent. Today, between 1 and 3 would probably be best if you want to talk to her. Ask the porter to send for me, and I'll arrange it. She signed it Savard.
Oscar looked at the back of the sheet of paper, as if he'd find some explanation for such oddness there.
From this, it sounds like she doesn't like you much.
She likes me just fine. Jack's tone said that he would entertain no more questions in that direction, which Maroney ignored.
Is that so? And what about you?
Jack picked up the newspaper and snapped it open.
I like me fine, too.
Ass,
Maroney said.
What's this about a nun?
She'll make it easier to get answers at the Foundling. After a long moment, Oscar said,
It's a damn odd way to court a woman, chasing around the city looking for orphans for, what, almost a month? You don't think you'll find them, do you?
Jack considered, and then lowered his paper.
It's unlikely, he said, but it's important to her.
Oscar said and picked up his own paper. From behind it, he said,
Tell me where you've been so far.
Jack pulled out his notes and slid them across the desk. It had taken long enough to get Oscar to ask for them. A nurse in training, who looked to be all of 15, showed Jack up to the 3rd floor of the New Amsterdam Charity Hospital, casting glances over her shoulder when she thought he might not notice, and then dropping her gaze to study the floor. He might have asked some questions, but he had the idea that she would have been too nervous to answer. Because he was with the police, or because he was male, or both, it was impossible to know. She stopped outside a room with wide double doors and spoke to him without meeting his gaze.
Dr. Savard said that if you would come in and sit at the back of the classroom, she'll be with you as soon as possible.
I'll do that. Thank you.
She hesitated as if she had something else to say, then fairly sprinted away down a hall. For almost a month now, Anna had been setting up little tests, as though she couldn't decide how to feel about him until she had put him through his paces. If she had grown up in an Italian family, her father would have gone after the same information in 1 15-minute sweat-soaked interview. Jack didn't know much about her own father, but maybe he would have let her handle things this way, feeling her way forward step by step.
He knew already how her mind worked.
She was sure that sooner or later, she'd reveal something about herself that would scare him off. He would decide that she was too forward, too opinionated, too educated. She would never defer to his opinion in anything except the law. She had no interest in keeping house. She was tough and uncompromising when it was called for. While she had never said it openly, he understood that she had no use for religion. She could be irritable, but she was usually willing to let herself be distracted. In the middle of a sharp commentary about the traffic or something in the paper, he would sometimes kiss her without warning. She always seemed surprised at first, and then suddenly pleased, and she always kissed him back. They had never discussed any of this, what it meant that she came to him gladly when he pulled her into a doorway and kept her there until she was soft and warm and pliant in his arms. Sometimes at night, hovering between sleep and waking, Jack asked himself the very questions she seemed determined to force. What would it take to make him see that they were not, in the end, suited? Thus far, he hadn't come up with an answer. Now he slipped into the classroom and sat in the back row to observe Anna as she taught. The room was not very large. 3 rows of chairs arranged in a semicircle around a center work table crowded with books and papers, beakers and covered bowls, and 3 microscopes. 8 young women were standing at the table, bent forward to watch as Anna described something she saw on the slide. One of them was Sister Mary Augustine, whose white bonnet and habit stood out against the dark blackboard as though she were lit up from the inside. Anna straightened and turned to the blackboard where she had already printed necrosis, epithelial, and something in Greek. And she teased him about Italian. As she spoke, she wrote out instructions. I want you to spend at least an hour preparing slides and then examining and documenting the tumor under the microscope. Your drawings and notes should be very specific, from the gross anatomical to cellular. You must discuss the tissue types as a foundation for your diagnosis. For tomorrow, I'd like you to write up a prognosis and treatment plan. You may work in pairs if you like. Questions? Sister Mary Augustine said something very soft and low, and Anna turned to her. You certainly are welcome to participate. Your patient will sleep for a few hours more, and a nurse will be sitting beside her until she wakes. Now, you'll have to excuse me while I speak to Detective Sergeant Mezzanotte. The little nun's head came up suddenly and her gaze fixed on Jack. He nodded to them both and left to wait in the hall. Jack said, Are you poaching souls from the Catholic Church? And was surprised to see that she was a little embarrassed. If you like, she said finally. In her office, she sat on the edge of the desk directly across from Jack, who was leaning against the door, though I'd characterize it more as responding to intellectual curiosity. She hasn't taken final vows yet, has she? What makes you think that? She's wearing white. Most of the other Catholic nuns I've seen wear black habits. She wears white because she's a nursing sister, Jack said. At the Foundling, all the nuns wear white. All the nursing nuns. Anna's expression shifted, irritation drawing a line between her brows. Apparently, she didn't like this particular fact about the Sisters of Charity. Why are you here, anyway? Jack took some pleasure in flustering her. There was no denying it. Because you sent for me. And before she could work up any more of a temper, he said, You are very good in the classroom. Very much in control, but not overpowering or unaware. You had their interest and attention. Now he had embarrassed her, but she was pleased, too. Thank you. She said quietly. When she raised her head again, she was smiling. Do you still have time to go to the Foundling on Sunday? He nodded. Sister Mary Augustine. There's something going on there, but I have no idea what. She seems subdued. The only way to know if she's willing to help is to ask her. They were silent for a long moment, just looking at each other. Then Sunday at noon, if that suits. But tonight, if you're still interested... She was waiting, her eyes on his face, her expression a study in hard-won composure. We could go up on the new bridge. We need to do it today or tomorrow, as I'm leaving Monday and I'm going to be away for a week or 10 days. Watching her expression closely, all he saw was a vague fluttering of her eyelids. I see, she said finally. I was hoping you'd be able to visit the Catholic agencies with Sister Mary Augustine while I'm gone. Of course, she said quite stiffly. I'm quite familiar now with the way things work. I'm sure I can handle further inquiries without you. You've spent too much time as it is. She was pivoting to go around the desk and sit down, but Jack stepped forward to take her wrist. She turned back to him with a jerk and looked at his hand as if it were contaminated. He couldn't help it. He laughed. Mezzanotte, please let go of me. Instead, he pulled her closer, and then, holding on to her upper arms, swung her around so that her back was against the door. He put his hands flat to either side of her head, but she was looking down. All her muscles tensed. Look at me. She raised her head, her eyes flashing with anger and what he thought might be disappointment. She said, I see I amuse you. Do you want to let me in on the joke? Her gaze fell to his mouth and then jerked away.
I am not leaving to get out of helping you.
It's none of my business. Why, you're...
He leaned down and caught her mouth in mid-lie. After she gave in with a small sigh, he kissed her again. Do you remember I told you about the swindle the DiPaccio brothers were running? Her expression cleared.
The train tickets to Chicago?
Yes. They sold somewhere around 500 forged tickets from Grand Central to Chicago for $10 apiece. She nodded, curious now. We put out a bulletin. Today we got a telegram from the Chicago police. All three brothers are sitting in their jail. You know how they caught them?
They spoke Italian to them.
That's my trick. No, the mopes were hanging around the train station selling fake tickets to Grand Central.
You have to go to Chicago to bring them back here.
Her color was rising.
And it's still none of my business, but I wish you a good trip.
Jack gave her a narrow look, and then, bending down, he put his mouth to her ear. It is your business, Savard, and I can prove it. She stiffened.
I have a reputation to uphold here.
Then stop lying to me, or face the consequences. He pressed his mouth to the soft skin just beneath her ear.
I forbid you to take advantage of me in this office.
He touched his tongue to her throat and felt her shiver. If kissing your neck is forbidden, how about... She grabbed his ears and pressed her forehead to his.
I have work to do. Let me go.
Just as soon as you admit.
Yes, all right. It's my business, too.
He kept waiting, and after a good while, she relaxed against him. Now that you're listening, I have a couple things to say. First, if you get word from Baldy...
Ned.
If you get word from Ned, don't go anywhere with him alone. Wait for me to get back. Are you going to be stubborn about this?
Oh, no, she said. I know better.
She did know better. She regularly saw hard proof of the damage done to vulnerable women, and yet he had needed to say it. Second, there's one advantage to this assignment. I'll have a couple extra days free over the summer. In June, sometime, I want you to come with me to Greenwood. Her expression went blank as she tried to place the name. Greenwood is where I grew up. My father's farm is a few miles south of the village.
You want me to come to Greenwood?
She said, a hitch in her voice so that she swallowed visibly before she went on.
You want me to meet your family?
I've met yours, Savard. Seems only fair. She was studying him.
Why?
Why do I want you to meet my family? He gave her his best frown. That's a question for a longer conversation. Jack stepped away just as someone knocked on the door. He watched Anna gather her thoughts and remind herself who she was. Then she opened it to find the same student nurse standing there.
Dr. Morris and Dr. Sweet need a surgical consult on a patient who just came in, she said, her eyes darting to Jack and then away.
Anna looked at him over her shoulder as she left the room. I'll come by for you tomorrow at 7, he said, as soon as I've finished my shift.
Just go away, Sister Xavier said to Mary Augustine, and leave me to my headache.
A headache is quite common after surgery, but it can be treated.
She added two more drops of laudanum to the glass of water she had ready, aware that her patient was watching every movement.
I see how it is with you, said the older nun, refusing to take the glass Mary Augustine offered. Meek as a mouse until you've got the weak and vulnerable to bully.
Mary Augustine allowed herself a small smile.
Yes, you've figured me out. I'm here to bedevil you.